We're continuing with the question of the Torah and morality, and the assumption you're saying within your question is that there is good and there is bad, and the Torah has to adhere to that, it would seem. There is moral and there is immoral, and the Torah, it would seem, would adhere to that. Maybe we should add a few more points. If a non-Jew is supposed to be able to figure out the Noahide laws, so then there is some level of logic that's supposed to lead me to at least the Noahide laws, to some understanding of a certain minimum level of morality, it would seem. Okay, so we're complicating things a little bit. I just want to reiterate what we said in part one. Without part one, I see no point in continuing to part two. Meaning, if we do not reach a point where we've reached clarity in the truth of God and His commandments in the Torah, then I see no point in continuing. Then, in fact, we have to take a step back and say, wait a second, is this religion right or is it not right? Don't go talking to me about killing. I'll talk to you about simpler mitzvot where they contradict or they could contradict what a human being wants or what a human being might think is moral. We could list many. I don't see the point right now. I'm just saying part one is critical. And without part one, whatever we're going to say in part two and three is going to be whitewash. Meaning, you could take many criminal activities and many heinous crimes and whitewash them. There was once a noble who came to the house of, I think, either Menachem ben Tzaruch or Dunash ben Labrat. And in the middle of Shabbos, he sent his soldiers, they came in, they plundered his house, they destroyed his house, and they pulled out his beard by force, they pulled out all his hairs. And it was based on lies, scandalous lies that were told to this noble. So he wrote him a letter, and he said, you know, I was always loyal to you, I did everything I could, how could you do this to me on Shabbos? So he writes him a letter back, listen to the chutzpah, he says to him, you know, if what I heard about you is true, that you were really plotting against me, so you deserved every iota of pain that you received, and I don't regret it. And if, like you say, you were always faithful, and it was all scandalous lies, so then, look, you suffered a little bit more in this world, and I only brought you closer to the world to come, so you owe me something for that too. So I'm not sure I should apologize either. So you understand, you could take anything and twist it in a certain way, and then say, in the name of God, say thank you. You know, Sodom also had a logic. The Sodomites, one person would throw a rock at someone else, make him bleed, and then come up and say, pay me. You know, bloodletting costs money. So you can take anything and twist it. So I feel like part two and three, which is going to be addressing from a logical perspective, how can I rectify mitzvot that I feel are counterintuitive, they only have validity if I've accepted part one. If you don't accept part one, if you haven't achieved part one, so I don't really see a point in continuing to part two and three. And that's why all the answers that in the interim everyone here was discussing, to my mind, they're nice. But they're all predicated on part one. You can't go on to all these answers without part one. And I think that's the world of a difference. And I feel like anyone who's going to try to give answers without it, I have a hard time accepting. Personally, I spent many years wondering about this. I spent many years wondering about many things. I mean, I'll tell you some of my dark history. When I was a child, I became a vegetarian because I couldn't see the difference between an animal and a human being. I lacked a little bit of intelligence. What can you do? But I tried to be moral, and I couldn't justify to myself eating another living organism just because we are mightier than it. So I spent about a decade being a vegetarian. It took me a long time to come to terms with the idea that I can eat fowl, excuse the pun. Okay, but it was a thought process. I'm saying, and the same is true with regard to the idea of fighting Amalek or other things. I remember as a vegetarian, people would ask me, what you're going to do when the base of Mikdash is going to be built? And I said, thank God I don't have to worry about that right now. You know, I didn't have an answer. Because at the root of it was a question, a burning question. You're right. And at the root of it was a certain doubt that I had in the whole validity of the system. So I was walking around saying, I don't know. People said, what did you do on Shabbos? I said, no pleasure for me to eat chicken. I'm going to vomit if I do. Nothing to talk about. It's not my own Shabbos. Okay, later on, I understood more. And then I developed from there. But I'm saying, it's a process. You can't just jump forward. If you haven't really worked it out, so then what are you doing? So that's why I felt that part one is critical. Now, part two. So how do we understand the Torah and morality, the Torah and good and bad? And I want to challenge you with a few questions from which we'll try to develop a thought. So about, this story must have been somewhere around 15, 17 years ago, maybe a little bit more, a train pulled up to the stop. It was rush hour, Midtown Manhattan. The subway train pulls up to the stop, and people load the train. And if you know what these trains look like, you're talking about a system that transports millions of people within an hour. You're talking about a huge system, the subway system in the U.S. I mean, each train, I don't know how many thousands of people are on each train, but you're talking about huge numbers. So you have this train packed with people, sitting, standing, okay? And the doors close, and the conductor is about to leave the station. Now, just so you understand what's going on here, when this train leaves the station, within about 3 seconds, another train pulls in. People load it. 3 seconds later, another train pulls in. Rush hour means that you have a few million people being transported from Midtown Manhattan to Long Island, to Borough Park, to Queens, all over. Okay? So, uptown, downtown, everyone's counting on these trains. And this is a main stop. And someone runs up to the conductor and says, I just saw a cat walk onto those tracks. And if you pull this train out of the stop, you're going to kill that cat. And if you kill that cat, I'm going to sue you in the name of the human rights, animal rights movement. So the conductor is looking at the person trying to figure out if they're serious or not. And the conductor says, you know, I got over 1,000 people in this train. They got to go home to their families. They have children waiting to be taken from schools. How could I not go? And the person said, you move, I sue. So the conductor says, what do I need to get fired for? He calls his boss. He says, what do I do? So the head of the station thinks for a second and says, what do I need to get fired for? So he calls, and this goes up. Now you understand, this takes time. So the train is sitting there. 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes. It's a big deal. I mean, 20 minutes for a train to sit at the stop, and it's a chain effect. You have people sitting in the tunnel behind. They can't get out. They can't get out of the train. And the train behind that, people can't get out. And now you start having backup. 20 minutes for a train to sit at a stop. Now you got a real problem. It hits the news. I mean, no one wanted to take the responsibility of being sued. So they send some animal catcher into the tracks, and they either they did or they didn't find the cat, whatever happened, but they did whatever they had to do to ensure they're not going to get sued, and the train pulls out. But the news was talking. For the next day or two, everyone's discussing what was the right call. And call-in stations, all the radio stations are talking about, like, what should they have done? So some people said, are you crazy? You know how many millions of people showed up late to their appointments, to their doctor appointments, to people that were waiting for them in hospitals, to their children who were waiting in schools. How could you do such a thing over a cat? And the animal rights people were calling in and saying, are you crazy? All those people put together couldn't bring back the life to that cat. Why does that cat have to suffer just because these people have to rush? And the city was bustling. You'd sit on the everywhere you're going for 2 days. You know, news lasts about that long when it's a big story. Everywhere you're going, you're hearing these radio talk station, and people are vehemently arguing their points. So everyone here probably has an opinion, and everyone here is convinced that their opinion is the moral way. But you understand that there's a group of people out there who have a different opinion, and they're just as convinced that their way is the moral way. Right now, I used to say history, but right now, if any of you know what's going on in the news, so there's a very, very, very big gap, a huge chasm has been created in the world of what's moral and what's considered moral values. You see, in Russia, it's basically illegal for a person to be gay. And in the United States, it's basically legal to the point where they could get married. So what's moral? Go ask the Russians. They'll say the Americans are crazy. Up until a few years ago in Russia, if a person was caught being gay, they'd be sent to an insane asylum, to a mental institution. Something's wrong with them. It's not that long ago. And in the United States, they're saying, oh, they could get married. They have all the legal rights of couples, right? Which way is moral? Go, yeah, you got half the world going this way, half the world going that way. And historically, the world's been fluctuating back and forth. I mean, Plato and Aristotle, they lived that life. And years later, I mean, up until this century, even in the United States, everyone thought you had to be crazy to be like that. So what's going to decide what's moral for us? You know, that's why I asked Ari, you're using the term as though humanistic good, the human good, has any meaning. Well, you know what? Let's go back 250 years ago. We once had a student here who liked to discuss the rule of thumb. You know, where he told us where the rule of thumb came from. You know where the rule of thumb came from?
Your wife.
Right? The rule of thumb was, if you're going to beat your wife, then the stick shouldn't be thicker than your thumb, because then you might hurt her. So long as it's less than the thickness of a thumb, that's okay. Rule of thumb. Go use that term again at home, yeah? And that was the moral United States.
Look at abortion 40 years ago, right? It's considered murder in the United States, flat out.
Oh, okay.
What, are you crazy? Is that the choice?
You know, President Reagan wrote a book, Conscience of a Nation. He wrote a book describing why he thinks it's so immoral to abort a baby. But you know what? People are on the other side of the fence saying it's immoral to force a woman to have a baby. That's not a baby. It's very interesting. You know, someone once wrote about how if you're a liberal, then an animal has a soul, but a fetus is just a pack of cells. Think about it. What's moral? Now, let's go back 250 years ago. One of the laws of the Puritans was that they had a stocking in the center of town, you know, where a person, they'd lock his hands and face in, and they had a special clip so that when a person felt his wife was too talkative at home and didn't speak with respect, he could bring her to that stocking, and they'd put her there and put a clip on her tongue, and she'd stand there for as long as the husband agreed with the authorities, but their tongue stuck out to shame her so that she'd learn her lesson that she shouldn't talk back to her husband. Moral or immoral? The wonderful Puritan, founding fathers of the United States. If you go back, up until 150 years ago, some people here are... up until 100 years ago, up until 100 years ago, the world agreed. It was like obvious to everyone that if your son misbehaves, you smack him, you beat him, of course, and your wife is no different. And she's just like one of the kids. If she misbehaves, you smack her or beat her. You think Abraham Lincoln didn't beat his wife? You think Thomas Jefferson didn't beat his wife? You think George Washington didn't beat his wife? I'm saying it was a given. It was obvious. You have to educate your kids, and she's one of them. No one thought twice. Moral or immoral? So the world is very fickle. You know, the world keeps changing its mind. What's moral or immoral?
Relative morality.
We haven't been relative. We've been very consistent. The world keeps coming closer to Judaism, but they like to call it the Judeo-Christian ethic. But it's not. It's two different worlds, Judeo and Christian. It's not the same thing. If you really understand what's at the root of the two, it's not one ethic. There's the Judeo ethic. The world is coming towards the Judeo and veering with the Christian. Meaning everything that's happening in Europe and the United States, where they're turning the other cheek and fighting for the rights of the Muslims, that's not Judeo, that's Christian. The Judeo ethic wouldn't let that happen.
What did Judeo ethic do?
That's a different class. But I'm saying, for starters, if we're going to talk about morality and ethics, we have to understand that The world's been changing. The world, the way you see it, well, go back 100 years. A woman couldn't own land. She couldn't vote. She couldn't sue a person. So, of course, you could take advantage of a woman. I'm saying, as a small example, in Judaism, that doesn't exist. A woman could own land. A woman could sue. A woman has rights. A woman has rights in a marriage. And that's been the case long before the world even thought such a concept could exist. That's been the case since the giving of the Torah. Look, B'nos Slavchot, our parsha. Look at that. Women have rights. Women can come to the top court. Think about it. What does that mean? These girls, they don't have a husband to represent them. They don't have a father to represent them. And they could come before Moshe Rabbeinu. Unheard of. And they have no problem. They walk in before Moshe. They have a claim. And the Shas is filled with it. You see, Yalta. She was upset at her husband. Went and broke 400 barrels. You're not going to talk to me that way. What did he do? He didn't offer her a cup of wine. He didn't offer her a cup of wine. So she goes up to the attic and breaks all his barrels. She obviously wasn't too scared. He'd pick up his whip and hit her, right? Because that the Judeo-ethic never had such a concept. Oh, there were unlearned people. There were always people who behaved like animals. That's not our ethic. That's our problem crowd. You have a crowd that's uneducated. You have a crowd that's not going with the Judeo-ethic. But the Judeo-ethic has been very consistent ever since the giving of the Torah. So, when you ask me, does the Torah fit with the human morality and ethics, the Torah doesn't have to. The Torah is really the conscience. The Torah is what's going to determine for us and tell us what's really ethical. And the rest of the world had no problem doing a lot of things if you study human history a little bit. I don't know if you know what's going on right now, a little bit north of us, up in Syria. If you want to talk about ethics and morality. Eating people while they're still alive.
What about ethics between people and God? We look at ethics between people and people and how we treat each other, but what about how we treat God? How does that work?
I think that's a separate question, and I don't think we're done here. This was just introductory. But let's pause.